Welcome to Andersonville National Historic Site. This site was authorized by Congress in October 1970 as a unit of the National Park Service. For many years prior to this time, both the cemetery and prison site were administered by the Department of the Army. Between 1890 and 1910, the prison site was cared for by the Grand Army of the Republic, a Union veterans organization, and its auxiliary, the Women's Relief Corps, as a memorial to the Andersonville prisoners. Andersonville, Georgia, was the location of a prisoner of war camp during the Civil War. Of the approximately 45,000 Union soldiers who were imprisoned at Andersonville, nearly 13,000 of them died during confinement. But why so many?
You may pull out of your parking space now. Please exit the parking lot. This tour is designed only as an aid to your visit with us. Feel free to stop at any point along the way and explore on your own. There are a number of wayside exhibits throughout the prison site area. These are designed to help you understand the story of Andersonville, so please leave your vehicle to take a closer look. When you do leave your car, please remember to pause or turn off the player so that when you return, it will be ready to resume the tour. This tour is designed for a speed of 10 miles an hour. Please drive at this speed so the sites you pass will coordinate with the tour, which also has numbered stops. When you return from the tour, the person on duty at the museum desk will be glad to answer any questions which may have developed during your visit. At the stop sign, turn left. Please watch carefully for oncoming traffic before proceeding. Follow the signs leading to the prison site ahead.
Please stop along the right side of the road across from the Wisconsin Monument, which will be on your left. This will be tour stop number one. At the onset of the Civil War, neither side was prepared for a prolonged conflict. Both sides earnestly believed that the war would be a short one. Therefore, no one really even considered the holding of the thousands of enemy soldiers who would eventually be taken prisoner. As the war dragged on, the necessity of caring for these prisoners became more apparent and critical. At first, both sides used a parole system, in many instances right on the battlefield. The prisoners would state on their honor that they would go home and fight no more until officially exchanged. This system was soon found to be impractical, forcing both sides to hold their prisoners. A formal prisoner exchange system was devised in July of 1862. The system was governed by the Dix Hill Cartel, which specified the worth of each soldier by rank. However, the cartel had many difficulties and soon broke down. In addition, the Union discovered that it was to their advantage not to exchange prisoners. As a result, large prisons like Andersonville were established. The earliest camps for Union prisoners were in and around Richmond, Virginia, the Confederate capital. By 1863, the prisoner population in Richmond had grown to the point that it caused a serious drain on the city's dwindling food supply. Richmond was under constant threat of attack, and General Robert E. Lee pointed out that the northern captives could prove to be a liability in the event of such an attack. The Confederate government began looking for alternative prison sites late in 1863. Eventually, Camp Sumter was built near the small southwest Georgia community of Andersonville, which had a population of approximately 20. This site was finally chosen because of its proximity to the railroad, the presence of a creek to be used as the water supply, the mild climate, an abundance of natural building material, and the reported availability of food in the surrounding area. In addition, southwestern Georgia at that time was far from the theater of war. In January 1864, impressed Negro slaves from the nearby plantations began clearing the land. For the next 6 weeks, the clatter of axes, the crash of trees, and the thud of shovels echoed as the sandy soil was stripped of its lofty pines. They cut the logs into 20 feet lengths, then hewed them by hand so they would fit closely together. The timbers were then placed upright in a 5 feet deep trench. One prisoner's diary mentions that the wall timbers were so close together that he could not see the guards' fires through the walls at night. The first group of prisoners arrived on February 24, 1864, when only three walls had been completed. The fourth side between the gates had to be guarded with artillery until it was finished. The stockade enclosing 16 and a half acres was originally planned to hold 6,000 prisoners, but was built to accommodate 10,000. However, the prison's population had soared to 25,000 by June. An expansion of 10 acres was added to the northern end of the stockade and was opened July 1, 1864, bringing the total acreage inside the prison walls to 26 and a half. The initial north wall of the stockade would have been on the line running east and west, located near the obelisk-shaped Ohio Monument. Although 26 and a half acres seems like a large area, keep in mind that there were 33,000 men confined here during its peak population in August of 1864. In addition, there were about 4 acres of uninhabitable boggy land along the stream. This understandably led to a rather crowded situation. As you circle the stockade, the outer concrete posts and stone corner markers will show you the outline of the enlarged stockade. The inner concrete posts mark the location of a small wooden railing. This crude fence, known as the deadline, was established by prison authorities in late March 1864 to make escape more difficult. The guards had orders to shoot any prisoner who ventured across the deadline. Spaced every 80 to 100 feet were 52 guard towers, or pigeon roosts, as they were commonly called by the prisoners. These provided a perch for guards to observe the prison's interior. Although we do not know the exact number killed at the deadline, we do know that most of the time it was strictly enforced. Please continue your drive around the prison site following the road down the hill towards the stream. The next stop, stop number 2, is at the bottom of the hill. When you arrive there, please pull into the parking area to your left. Two gates, both located on the west wall, provided access to the stockade. Each had two sets of doors and formed a small enclosure. One set of doors opened to the stockade, with the other opening to the outside. One set was always closed, and they were strongly guarded at all times. New prisoners entered through the north gate, located on the hillside north of the stockade branch, where they got their first introduction to Andersonville Prison. Before entering, they were divided into detachments of 270 men, which were further divided into squads of 90 men and mess groups of 30 men for the purpose of receiving food rations. On the hill to your left is a reconstruction of the north gate and a section of the west wall. John McElroy of the 16th Illinois Cavalry wrote about his first sight of Andersonville.
500 weary men moved slowly through double lines of guards. 500 men moved silently toward the gates that were to shut out life and hope for most of them forever. A quarter of a mile from the railroad, we came into a massive palisade made of great squared logs standing upright in the ground. The fires blazed up and showed us a section of these and two massive wooden gates with heavy iron hinges and bolts. They swung open as we stood there, and we passed through into the space beyond. We were in Andersonville.
The stream that you see crossing the prison site is Stockade Branch, the principal water source for the prisoners and one of the deciding factors in locating the prison here. From this small stream, the prisoners obtained water for drinking, bathing, and laundry. In addition, the toilets, or sinks in Civil War terminology, were built along this brook on the downstream side of the camp. Stockade Branch may have been a sufficient water supply for the 6 to 10,000 men for which the prison was originally designed. However, with the overcrowding, this stream was quickly overburdened. Waste from the bakehouse and the guard camps upstream polluted Stockade Branch before it even entered the prison. In their search for a better water supply, some prisoners located small brackish springs along the hillside or dug wells. Those who located water often sold it to their fellow prisoners. John Ransom, a prisoner here, wrote in his diary on May 18th,
"Some of the wells dug by the Yankees furnished passable water, an improvement anyway on the swamp water. Well water in great demand is sold readily for such trinkets as the men have to dispose of.
During the hot, dry summer of 1864, the prisoners' need for water became so great that they began to pray to God for help. In August, a heavy rainstorm transformed Stockade Branch into a raging torrent that washed away part of the stockade wall. It also gave the camp a greatly needed cleansing. According to legend, during the storm, lightning struck the ground. Upon investigation, a spring was discovered flowing where the lightning had struck. Since many prisoners felt this was the answer to their prayers, it was named Providence Spring. John Ransom simply wrote on August 13th,
"A nice spring of cold water has broken out in camp, nearly enough to furnish all here with drinking water. God has not forgotten us."
The memorial building over Providence Spring was erected in 1901. You may want to get out of your car and walk down to the spring for a closer look. You may also wish to walk up the hill to explore the reconstructed North Gate. Remember to pause or turn the player off now so that it will be ready to resume the tour when you return. Continue with the tour. Please pull off to the right side of the road as you approach the two stone pillars ahead of you on your left. This is stop number 3. Located in the area to the left of the bridge is the site of the bakehouse. It was originally planned to issue the prisoners cooked food. However, as a result of the scarcity of lumber, bricks, and cooking utensils, the bakehouse was not completed when the first trainload of prisoners arrived. By the time it was finished, the prison population had soared, rendering it inadequate. Often rations were uncooked. Many times the food was spoiled or infested with bugs. The meagerness of the daily food ration and its lack of variety caused severe dietary deficiencies. This, coupled with the overcrowded conditions, the inadequate shelter, and the poor sanitary conditions, resulted in widespread disease and a high mortality rate among the prisoners. The pillars to your left mark the location of the South Gate. Prisoners who died within the enclosure were laid just inside this gate. Later, the bodies were carried to the dead house, which stood to your right. The dead house was a crudely built shelter of pine boughs. Here, the bodies were kept until they were transferred by wagon to the cemetery. It was very common for friends of the deceased to stay with the body at the south gate. This gave them an opportunity to carry their friend to the dead house, and perhaps along the way they could pick up a few small pieces of firewood, a valuable addition to the scarce supply. At least one man attempted to escape by having his friends carry him out as if he were dead. Charles Mosher from the 85th Regiment New York Infantry wrote about this in his diary on June 16th.
"There has been several cases where a Yank has played dead, and his chums would tie a rag around his head to keep his jaw in place, tie his big toes together, pin a slip of paper to his clothing with his name, company, and regiment on it, and then, in a very solemn manner, carry the poor fellow out to the dead house. But the Yank had his weather eye opened, and, watching his opportunity when the guards are out of sight, steps quietly out of his dead surroundings and makes a break for the Union lines."
Please continue with your tour. On the right at the top of the hill is Star Fort, the primary earthwork in the fortification system surrounding the prison. When you reach the top of the hill, please stop your car in the parking area next to the Star Fort and the boardwalk. This is stop number 4. Fearing that General Sherman's army would attack and free the federal prisoners, Camp Sumter's commander, General John Winder, ordered Star Fort and other earthworks to be constructed in late July and August. These fortifications were hastily constructed by the prison guards and slaves. In addition to the earthworks, a second stockade wall was constructed and a third one started. This third wall was called the Covered Way, and although it was never completed, it did connect the earthworks on the northern and eastern sides of the prison. In case of an attack, this wall would enable the Confederate guards to move from one earthwork to another without being under direct fire. Although General Sherman's army continued on its march to the sea, one of his cavalry officers, General George Stoneman, did attempt to liberate the prisoners here. This attempt was thwarted when he and about 500 of his men were captured on July 31, 1864, at Hillsboro, Georgia, approximately 60 miles north of the prison. Five of the guns in the fort were trained upon the stockade enclosure at all times. These could effectively cover the prison area north of Stockade Branch. In addition, a small redoubt just west of North Gate had three guns covering the area south of Stockade Branch. It was well known by the prisoners that the cannon could sweep the enclosure with grape shot and canister upon a moment's notice. Fortunately, this drastic measure was never required. Please direct your attention to the large open field opposite Star Fort, the location of the Shedd Hospital. The hospital was comprised of 22 sheds, each 100 feet long and 22 feet wide, to accommodate 50 patients. It was definitely an improvement over the two previous hospitals, where the patients were housed in tents, yet this was still far from adequate. Nonetheless, the patients fared much better than the prisoners within the stockade enclosure. Disease became more prevalent as the prison population grew. It quickly became obvious that the lack of proper medical facilities and shortage of medical supplies was critical. The doctors relied upon their own ingenuity and improvised home remedies to replace the drugs which they could not obtain. Solon Hyde, a prisoner paroled from the stockade to work as a nurse, wrote after the war,
"The stock of drugs was meager. There was only a limited quantity of quinine, opium, and other mercurial preparations, mostly consisting of herbs and roots, such as sumac berries, white oak bark, prickly ash, prickly alder, willow bark, dogwood bark, snake root, and juniper berries, along with golden seal. These all came from and were packed by the Confederate Medical Dispensary in Macon, Georgia."
Feel free to get out of your car and walk into Star Fort. However, please help us preserve this remarkable structure by using the boardwalk and by not climbing over the banks and sides of the earthwork, because this increases the potential for erosion. Remember to pause or turn off the player now so that it will be ready to resume the tour when you return. Please continue with your tour. Pull out of the parking lot and continue to circle the prison site to your right. As you drive along the south end of the stockade, look to the left and you will see a lone white post low on the slope of the hill. This post marks the site where six raiders were hanged. The lack of order and overcrowded conditions within the prison enabled groups of thieves to become established. Since there was no organized police force, these gangs, called raiders, became very powerful. The area along the south end of the prison stockade was where gangs of raiders were camped. Realizing something had to be done to control the lawless gangs, prisoners grouped together, forming the Regulators, an unofficial police force. With the cooperation of Captain Henry Wirz, the Regulators finally gained the advantage, capturing many of the raiders. The six ringleaders were singled out and tried by a jury of 24 Union sergeants. A prisoner acted as counsel for the defense. Captain Wirz provided books of law to ensure the fairness of the trial, and proceedings of the trial were recorded. Found guilty, the six were hanged on July 11, 1864. After the execution, the Regulators continued to maintain some degree of order. Behind the earthworks ahead is the location of a temporary hospital site. Used after the original hospital inside the stockade was abandoned and while awaiting construction of the Shedd hospitals about which you've just learned. Movement of the hospital tents from the interior of the stockade freed up much needed space and provided slightly better conditions for the patients. As you approach the bridge, you will see stop number 5, which features a reproduction of an August 1864 photograph of the sinks, or latrines in modern terminology. The sinks were a major contribution to the pollution of the prisoners' primary source of water because they were built over the stream. Polluted water added to the spread of diseases such as diarrhea, dysentery, and typhoid. If you care to examine the photograph closely, you may want to pause or turn off the player. Please continue your drive up the hill to stop number 6. This exhibit features a photograph also taken in August 1864 that shows the conditions in which the prisoners lived. Because the Confederate authorities did not provide any building materials, the individual was left to fend for himself using whatever was available. As a result, a hodgepodge of shelters as simple or elaborate as the builder's imagination and resources existed. Blankets, tent halves, and bits of clothing were fashioned into crude lean-tos. These shebangs, as the prisoners called them, offered only meager shelter. Amos Stearns described a friend's shebang in his diary.
Chapney's shebang consisted of two army blankets, fastened together with wooden pins, and put up like an A-tent, which, with a poncho for the end, made a comfortable shelter compared with what the majority of prisoners had.
As you look at the photograph, compare the sights depicted to the present-day view looking north. You may want to stop the tour here to spend additional time making your comparison. Please continue your tour to stop number 7. While you are at this stop, you may wish to examine the reconstructed northeast corner of the prison and the reproduced shelters displayed here more closely. To supplement their meager rations, many men set up shops to peddle whatever wares they could make or procure, or whatever services they could perform. Understandably, these small businessmen dealt mainly in the necessities of life. Not all of the prisoners had the resources to start a business. However, most prisoners did find something to occupy the idle hours of captivity. Although any activity which offered relief from the daily reminder of being a prisoner of war was popular, the thought of escape seemed to be a particularly favorite pastime. For many, the only hope of escape seemed to be through tunneling. Robert Kellogg, a prisoner from Connecticut, recalled in his memoirs,
"The work of completing a tunnel had been silently going on, and we hoped to be successful in keeping it from the peering eyes of the rebels. But in some way, they discovered it, for the Reb quartermaster came in with men and the necessary implements and filled up the place, thus blasting one more hope."
Please continue your tour to stop number 8 at the parking area ahead on your right. As you drive to this stop, notice the small iron fences on your left. Inside them are the remains of escape tunnels and wells. Escape was difficult because of the remoteness of Andersonville from the Union lines and the efficiency of the dogs used to track down runaways. During the existence of the prison, only 329 prisoners are known to have made successful escapes. Many of these did so by running away from work details or by violating their paroles during employment outside the stockade. Camp Sumter existed for 14 months. With the release of the prisoners at the war's end, the stockade wall slowly rotted away. However, the story of Andersonville continued. Andersonville had become a very well-known name in the North. It was one of the largest Confederate military prisons, and it had a very high death rate. Emotions came to a peak as the released prisoners made their way home and told their stories. The Northern public was outraged. Since General John H. Winder, post commander, had died just prior to the war's end, the bulk of the responsibility for Andersonville fell upon Captain Henry Wirz. Wirz, commandant of the inner stockade, was tried by a military tribunal in Washington, D.C. The Swiss immigrant was found guilty of conspiring to injure the health and destroy the lives of federal prisoners and murder in violation of the laws of war. He was hanged on November 10, 1865. Despite numerous claims, mostly by embittered former inmates, there appears to have been no conspiracy. Captain Wirz contended that he was following the orders of his superiors and that he was unable to get the food and supplies necessary for the care of such a large number of prisoners. The prosecutor at Wirz's trial strived to understand how one man could allow such atrocities to occur, a question that even today bears heavily upon the minds of many people and the conscience of the nation. Andersonville has often been compared to many of the other Civil War prison camps. But is it fair to compare one to another? All prison camps were horrible places and at any given time experienced similar conditions. At Camp Douglas in Chicago, Illinois,
10% of its Confederate prisoners died during one cold winter month. And Elmira Prison in New York State, with a death rate of 25%, very nearly equaled that of Andersonville. Each is part of one of our nation's most tragic experiences. Civil War prisoner John Ransom wrote in his diary in June 1864,
"I've read in my earlier years about prisoners in the Revolutionary War and other wars. It sounded noble and heroic to be a prisoner of war, and accounts of their adventures were quite romantic. But the romance has been knocked out of the prisoner of war business higher than a kite. It's a fraud."
You may get out of your vehicle here, if you like, and take a closer look at the wells and escape tunnels. You may also find a monument erected by your home state. Please remember to pause or turn off the player now so that it will be ready to resume the tour when you return. Andersonville National Historic Site commemorates all prisoners of war throughout our nation's history. The state monuments, the wells and tunnels dug by the prisoners themselves, and the National Cemetery all stand as monuments to these prisoners. The purpose of monuments is not only to commemorate the past, but to teach lessons to the present. This concludes the tour of the prison site. Please pull out of your parking space, traveling to your left. At the intersection, turn onto the road to the right. At the next intersection, you will have the option to continue with the tour of Andersonville National Cemetery or of returning to the museum. If you wish to take the cemetery tour, proceed ahead to the sign marked Cemetery Tour Begins and stop. Continue with the cemetery tour when the narration begins. If you do not wish to continue with this tour, please stop now and return it to the museum. Thank you.